Okay, so we'll get started, and today we'll be doing the propositional logic as an analogy representation scheme. Before I go forward, are there questions? Yes.
I've been to chapter 6.
What is chapter 6? What? Game theory. I mean the adversarial search.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get back to it later.
Okay.
We'll get back to adversarial search later because people like that stuff, but I get back to it later. Okay. We'll do that as well as Markov decision processes later. Other questions?
So we're in chapter 8.
This is, I think the readings for whatever I'm doing are always on the web. If you look at, let's say, lecture notes, there, propositional logic is 7.1, 7.6, okay? And then after that, we will shift to probabilistic propositional logic, which is chapter 13, I think. And then we'll get after that to first order logic, and then after that, we will get back to adversarial search, and then learning at some point. That's the direction we go. So either we had a reduction in the class size, or people are really working hard on their projects instead of showing up here.
Shrink even more after that project.
That would be good, you think? So how is the project coming along? How many of you have sort of made good enough progress that you'll be done by Tuesday? Okay, and the people who don't show up don't get to show their hands, so we can't help it. So I am fine with shifting the project as well as homework deadlines to be next Thursday instead of next Tuesday, okay? And so that would be fine with me because I think I noticed that both are due on 24th, and for some reason I thought it was Thursday. So it's okay with me if both are submitted on Thursday, okay? But again, I think the part of the issue that you have to understand is you need to communicate to me if you're completely stuck in projects. And, I think if nobody gets back to me, I assume people are doing good progress. You know, I refuse to assume that you're all lazy bums and who don't even want to actually get up and send a mail saying I'm stuck, okay? So I think if people are doing good progress, then we'd like to have a lot more projects. And if you don't have, if you're stuck, then we would have to go slower in terms of project deadlines. If you don't care, then I ignore you, okay? because I think that doesn't, it makes no sense to worry about people who don't actually have the time or the inclination. They can always drop the course and find something else to do. Okay. So anyway, so Thursday would be the due date, I guess, for both the homework and the project. And then make sure that you get the help you need on both of them if you're getting stuck. In general, I want you to do project one well because I think sort of if you have no clue with that, then the second one isn't going to be, you're not going to have too much fun doing it either. Okay. Any other questions?
Is there project due before class or in class?
Okay, so that's the other thing. Projects are due in class at the beginning of the class. Okay, so you skip the class and you try to give me the project after the class, that's one day late. Okay, so I don't want you to be, doing your reports instead of showing up here. Okay, the expectation is that everything is due at the beginning of the class in person. Okay, that's the basic idea. If in fact things are really bad for you and you need an extension on a case by case basis, I would still rather. Your chances of getting that are higher if you actually show up to the class than not showing up to the class and sending me a mail saying I've been very busy doing my project. Do you think you'll give me a extension? And the answer would be stony silence on my part. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
Is there a particular report for the partner?
Yeah, basically you are supposed to, I mean, again, as I said, once the code works, that's when things get more interesting as far as this project is concerned, right? And so you provide a report explaining what it is that you're able to see in terms of the performance of the search on the different problem sizes with different heuristics. That's for the required part. Okay. Yes.
What all is supposed to be printed out like after you run it? You're going to get our group.
So I'll make sure that the TA sends detailed instructions on this. But you don't need to print, other than one problem or so. You don't need to print long traces, for example, of the search being done. Saying I picked up this node now, etc. kind of thing. But he would, the TA would make sure that your code is submitted. I mean, there would be instructions as to how to submit it in software form. And if there is reasons to believe that you made up the numbers, they'll run the code. Okay, and don't, obviously, that you don't want to get caught. Okay, so because you just get, you're expected to be honorable, and if we find that you aren't, that's the only chance you have, and then so you don't obviously want to take that chance. But as far as the code should be there, the code should be commented, and then there should be a report explaining what you learned from running the various problems and whether it corresponded to what has been discussed in the class or not. Okay, can I get a sheet of paper from you? Okay. Write your name and sign. This is going to be the attendance sheet. I just want to make sure. I could do a pop quiz today, but I think since you showed up, I don't want to make you unhappy. so because next week there won't be anybody, if there's a pop quiz. I did think of nice pop quiz questions, but, I decided eventually it's not worth it. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Yes.
So do you update the slides like right before class?
I am always updating. Yeah. That's how I keep myself happy. I mean, otherwise I get bored to death. I've been teaching this course forever. So I think that's the only way. But more or less, if you look at the slides from the last year, they're more or less close to what I would be doing. But I am, updating the flow, updating the pieces, everything. That's what I do when I'm coming back for the class. Other questions? Okay. So what we're going to do today is looking at propositional logic as a knowledge representation scheme. Now, propositional logic is already just a subset of CSP representation, right? Because there is CSP, and the Boolean CSP is nothing but that, and propositional logic is basically satisfiability problem. Okay? But what we are going to look at in today's class now basically is to look at writing the constraints. Previously, we just talked about the CSP constraints are just, we didn't spend too much time about the syntax of the constraints. All we said was ultimately a constraint over, three variables x, y, z would be legal partial assignments on those three variables. So set of legal partial assignments. How you represent that, I left it alone, left it unsaid. Basically, I actually told you that as far as the CSP algorithms are concerned, each constraint can be a procedure. It's a function. It takes current assignment and says yes or no. Yes means yes, there are, the current assignment is not violating any constraint. No means, violating this constraint. And no means, no, this constraint is violated by the current assignment already. Okay, we didn't spend too much time about the syntax of the representation of the constraints. Now that we are actually going to be looking at SAT, we will focus on the syntax. And furthermore, we will focus on writing all our knowledge in that syntax, okay, and then talk about things like inference. So knowing what I know, can I prove that more things will follow? Okay, and that's the kind of thing that we'll be looking at. And one of the things, as we discuss this, one of the things that you want to keep in mind is essentially that if you remember the CSP search algorithm, when you did forward checking, when you did constraint propagation, you were trying to consider what you currently know at that search node and using that to prove to yourself that there is no hope in this path. That means it's dead. Or prove to yourself that some of the future variables cannot take certain values. Okay, what you did there was essentially theorem proving. Okay, we didn't call it theorem proving, we called it constraint propagation, we called it forward checking. And in fact, much of today's lecture is going to be the background on this theorem proving. Exactly when can you say that a certain sentence follows from what you already know? Okay, so you can think of today's lecture in terms of formal basis for constraint propagation or forward checking. And what that also means then is that one of the things that will become clear as we go on is in CSP you are doing search, right? You're doing partial assignments, you're checking whether the partial assignment can be taken to a complete assignment. There is a search aspect. At each node, you also stop and try to prove to yourself that there's no point going forward. So you're doing search and inference together. Okay, this is exactly how the world works. Okay, so you're trying to search by actually splitting the values that a variable can take into two different branches. And in each branch, you're trying to prove to yourself that there's no point in going forward. Okay, that proving is basically what we'll talk a lot about today. That's the theorem proving part. And the search is model finding. Model finding is a more fancy word for finding a consistent assignment for the set of variables. Okay, and so search and inference are essentially yin and yang. They go together. You know, you can interleave search into inference, inference into search. Okay, today we'll actually talk about how inference can be done, and we'll show that inference itself will contain search. Okay, proving a theorem involves searching over all possible proofs to look for one that works. Okay, and similarly, finding a correct assignment, which is model finding, involves searching over all models and looking for one that actually satisfies all the constraints. And you can interleave these. Okay, search and inference would be interleaved. So since we spent a lot more time with search in the foreground in the last couple of classes, today we will be spending time with inference in the foreground. Okay, and then as I said, we'll also talk about how to spend more time talking about the syntactic representation of the constraints, what are the semantics, and so on. Okay, so the reason this is interesting is when we talked about the agent architectures, we had said essentially one thing you want to do is write down everything that's known to the agent into a knowledge base. And then the agent asks itself, what should I do now? Okay, so presumably if I have some language, I need a language in which I can write down everything I know about the world. And then once I write it down, there's no point in writing it down unless I can use that knowledge to make inferences on what I should do next. Okay, and so that's another reason why propositional logic is being looked at, because it is one of the simplest representation languages we will look at. Okay, and if you ever have a representation language, you need to talk about the semantics of that language. So if I write a sentence, what does it mean? And the semantics are intimately connected to, if I have a whole bunch of sentences that are true in my world, is it also true that this new sentence will be true in my world? Okay, and that is basically inference, and that's actually also called entailment. And entailment is the cornerstone of logic. Okay, so in any logic, you want to write down what you know about the world you are living in, and you want to check if certain facts are entailed by what you know. Okay, computation of entailment is really the central enterprise, central problem of the logic. Okay, so that's what we're going to look at. And so, in a simple knowledge-based agent, you should be able to have a knowledge representation language that can represent states, that can represent actions, that can represent new percepts, and should then be able to use what it has represented to infer whether certain actions are feasible, whether certain actions should be done, whether there are hidden properties, what are the values of some hidden properties of the world, and finally, of course, as I said, what's the next action to do? That's ultimately the question that you're going to answer. Okay, and in supporting this, this part is representation, this part is reasoning, and then you can talk about different kinds of logics for representing about the knowledge about the world, and then for every logic, you talk about how to do entailment computation. Okay, logic in general is just a formal language where the syntax defines, basically the structure of the sentences in the language, and then the semantics would talk about what does that sentence represent. Okay, in terms of syntax, for example, and the semantics represent meaning of the sentences, and in general, the best way to think of a meaning of a sentence is to think that a sentence S is really nothing but a set of worlds where that sentence is true. The set of all worlds where that sentence is true. Okay? And then that winds up being very useful because then you can talk about if in fact I have a knowledge base which is true in whole set of worlds, then to check whether a new sentence is also true, I just need to look at set intersection operations between the two sets that we'll get to in a minute. So at the at the bottom of it all, entailment is just set theoretic idea. Except we are talking about huge sets, and so you need to talk about how to compute it efficiently. Okay. In fact, for small languages, such as propositional logic, the possible set of worlds is always guaranteed to be finite. And when we get to things like first order logic, the set of possible worlds can be infinite. Okay? Anyway, so here is a logic, here is a logic which is basically mathematical logic where you're talking about syntax for writing arithmetic formulas. Okay? And then, for example, this is syntactically correct, this is not syntactically correct because you decided what the syntax is. Okay? And then once you decide the syntax, then the semantics is, so x plus 2 greater than or equal to y is true in all the worlds where in fact, so this basically represents all the worlds. There are infinite number of them, right? Where x and y, where this particular inequality is satisfied. So for example, in a world where x equal to 7 and y equal to 1, this sentence is satisfied. Okay, so meaning of a sentence can be thought of in terms of being able to enumerate all the worlds where that sentence is true. Okay, for arithmetic, obviously, the number of worlds is already infinite. So this is the last time you'll be looking at arithmetic for a while. Okay, because we want to be able to deal with finite sets of worlds. Okay, so now, having said this, then as far as our knowledge representation languages are concerned, this is like the bird's eye view of what we'll be doing starting now for the next several weeks. Okay, so basically logics can be thought of in terms of two commitments that they make about the world. Okay, one is an ontological commitment as to what does the logic think the world is made up of. The other is an epistemological commitment which says what is its state of knowledge. Does it think that the state of knowledge is definitely true versus definitely false, or is it essentially a degree of belief? Okay? So if you want to look at some of the ones that we'll be looking at is starting with propositional logic. Propositional logic thinks the world is made up of statements that are true and false. That's it. So propositional logic doesn't think there are objects. So it's a non-object-oriented logic. Okay? It thinks the world is made up of sentences that are true or false. Okay? And furthermore, it thinks that the truth and falsity are categorical. Either it's true or it's false in any given world. Okay, there is no degree of belief. Okay, so then starting from propositional logic, so basically if you have these two axes, one is epistemological commitment, one is ontological commitment. And in the ontological commitment side, you can, world is made up of facts here, world is made up of facts, objects and relations, you know, which is much more richer representation of a world. Similarly, on the side, the world is made up of categorically true, false things versus degrees of belief. Okay, then propositional logic lives here. Now, starting from propositional logic, you can go just on top of this axis and say, well, I still believe that things are either always true or things are, you know, either categorically true or false, but I believe that my world actually has objects and relations between objects. Okay, if you do that, you go from propositional logic to first order logic. Okay, so first order logic is an object-oriented logic. That's the easiest way to remember it, you know, if those of you who are coming from programming languages background. Because it assumes that the world, it, in essence, as part of the language, it assumes that there are actually objects out there. Now, it's not that propositional logic cannot deal with worlds that have objects. All it does is, whether or not there are objects, it just ignores them. It thinks, essentially, that there are only sentences that are true or false. So a particular object might wind up taking part in a huge number of sentences. And the logic itself doesn't realize that there is the same object taking part in multiple sentences. You can write programs whether or not you have object-oriented programming languages. The difference is object-oriented programming languages might provide natural modeling of the program because you know what is the object and you know the and you know what are the methods on that and so on. Okay, so you go from propositional logic, if you add objects and relations, you get to first-order predicate logic. And we'll do that later. But you can also do propositional logic to degree of belief. That means, how much do I believe that this, in this world, this sentence will actually wind up being true? Okay, and that degree of belief, if you assume that, you know, it's no longer categorical, but I only have degrees of belief, then you start talking about probabilistic logic. So if you do that, you just go on this axis and get to probabilistic propositional logic. So you still don't believe that there are any relations and objects, but you assume that things may not just be true or false. It may be, you know, true with a certain probability. Okay. And then if you add both of them, so if you allow both objects and relations as well as degrees of belief, then you get probabilistic first order logic, which we would not talk much about in this class because the work in that area is still reasonably new. Okay, there isn't any well understood probabilistic first order logic formalism right now. Okay, there are steps towards it and you can read about them in other graduate classes, but you know, we would not be talking too much about them in this particular case. Okay, so from the point of view of propositional logic, essentially, you can go this way, objects and relations, you get first order logic. You generalize it to degree of belief, you get probabilistic propositional logic. You go from here and add degree of belief, you get to first order probabilistic logic. Or you go from here and add objects and relations, you again get to first order probabilistic logic. And it turns out you can do other things. So, for example, first order predicate logic assumes that there are objects and worlds. But if you also want to assume that there is a specific kind of thing in your world called time, and you want to be able to write time as part of your logic, so it's sort of, you know, compiled into the logic, then essentially you would get first order temporal logic. Okay, so this is basically the way, based on what you believe are existing in the world for sure, you get different kinds of logic. And based also on what sort of, whether you think a sentence will be categorically true or false versus whether it's a degree of belief, you get probabilistic propositional logic. Okay? So that's the general direction that we're going, and then we'll start here today. Now, I mentioned that each sentence can be thought of as the world that it represents. Okay, so a sentence really denotes, a semantics, basically these are called denotational semantics, a sentence S denotes the set of words where it is true. That's the meaning of a sentence. Okay? Without actually going into the specific syntax, in any logic, a sentence represents the set of words where it is true. Okay? If that is the case, then suppose I have the set of words where the sentence is true are called the set of models of the sentence. That means those are all the words where it actually is true. Okay. Now, here's the interesting thing. If I have a knowledge base, KB, okay, that's true in a set of words, and I want to check if particular sentence alpha is true whenever this knowledge base is true. So I want to check KB can be multiple sentences. Okay. So if in fact I have a set of sentence S1 which is true in world W1, set of world W1, S2 which is true in set of world W2, then the sentence S1 and S2 would be true in what world? What is the set? That would be true in W1 intersection W2. Okay. Similarly, S1 or S2 would be true in W1 union W2. So if a knowledge base has multiple sentences, I can do these kinds of operations to get the actual set of words that it stands for. Okay. Let's say that KB stands for W, set of words. Okay. So this is basically the set of words where KB is true. Now, I am checking whether some new sentence alpha will be true given that I know that KB is true. Because if it's my knowledge base, right, that means it describes the world I'm living in. It doesn't uniquely describe the world because there are many, many worlds where what I know is true. So all I know when I wrote some things in my knowledge base is I must be living in one of these worlds. You understand? And now suppose alpha is a sentence, so alpha is also a set of words. Alpha is also a set of words, right? So I could do like this. So here is alpha 1. This is set of words alpha 1. Here is alpha 2. That's another set of words. Okay? Here is alpha 3. That's yet another set of words. Which can I be sure is going to be true given my knowledge base is true? What? Alpha 2? Who all think alpha 2 is going to be true given what I know? Okay. If my knowledge base is true, that means I am in any of these worlds. So I could, for example, be in this world 5. If I am in world 5, would alpha 2 be true? Right? It needs the superset, not the subset. The entailment is about, I don't quite know which of the worlds I am in. If I have complete knowledge about my world I am in, then the set of worlds consistent with my knowledge base would be a singleton. Do you understand what I'm saying? And if my knowledge base is inconsistent, the set of worlds consistent with my knowledge base would be an empty set. Okay. If my knowledge base is partial, that means I know partial knowledge about the world I am living in, then basically I could be, what I'm saying is that I could be in one of the worlds W1 to W100. I don't know which one. And I want to say, is alpha true in my world? Well, alpha would be true in my world if, in fact, alpha is true in every one of W1 to W100. It could be true other places, I don't care. But as long as it's true in all the worlds where I could possibly be in, I am allowed to write alpha given what I know. Do you understand what I'm saying? Inference is not going to give you new knowledge. It only makes explicit the knowledge that you should already have had given what you know. That's what inference is. Inference is very different from learning. It's not an it's not a leap of faith and saying maybe, I mean, when I say I could be in one of the world W1 to W100, let's say, let me take a chance and assume I'm in W57. That's not inference. That's just guess. Okay? What we are interested in entailment computation really is every world that I could be in, is that a world where alpha would definitely be true? If so, then I can go ahead and assume that given what I know, alpha is true. That's exactly what this picture shows. Okay? So if the set of worlds where my knowledge base is true is this circle, this little set, and the set of worlds where alpha is true is this big set, since every world where my knowledge base is true, alpha is also true, I am allowed to say alpha holds whenever my knowledge holds. Now it looks like a total letdown. I made a huge deal about entailment. You know, there's this big magical thing that's going to come. Okay, but magic cannot be computed. So anything that is actually doable at the bottom level should be very depressingly obvious. Okay, and the only thing, the reason, you know, it may still take time is because, for example, the sets could be very large, and computing this entailment can take a long time. Yes, sir.
Sir, what if the reverse of the, this is there, like
what?
The KB is bigger set, and alpha is a smaller set. Does that mean that alpha is true for?
It's all you can be sure. So if in this particular case, by the way, in this particular case, that everybody wanted alpha 2 to be true, right? Let's say W5 is, so the KB is true in W1 to W100. Okay? Alpha is, let's say, true in W1 to W20 of them. Now, at this point, you are not allowed to say alpha is true, given my knowledge base. You can still say that alpha is sort of likely to be true, because if I am likely to be present in each of the one worlds, W1 to W100, equally likely, so 20% chance that, you know, I would be in a world where alpha is also true. So this degree of belief, essentially, the probabilistic logic would say in this case that alpha 2 is entailed with probability 0.2. Whereas propositional logic will keep its mouth shut, because it says either I'll tell you whether it is true or it's not true. You know, if it's sort of possibly true, it's as good as not true. I mean, so I will tell you whether alpha is true or whether not alpha is true. But in between are cases where alpha may or may not be true. And propositional logic ignores that possibility because it does not want to make a commitment on that. If you want to start dealing with degrees of belief, then you can talk about the percentage of worlds where alpha, you know, where the knowledge base is true, where alpha is also true. Now, a little more interesting stuff can be done. For example, in doing this, I assume that I could be in the worlds W1 to W100 with equal likelihood. In normal probabilistic logic, actually, I might have specific probabilities to each of these worlds too. And so really what you would be computing then is the probability mass for this subset compared to the overall subset. This also is an interesting issue, because I'm surprised that nobody asked me why am I not talking about this. I didn't want to talk about it there because I didn't quite have the example ready. I was going to show it to you next class, but this will tell me, this will give you an example as to the difference between probabilistic propositional logic and fuzzy logic. In the probabilistic propositional logic, so in this particular case, I do know that alpha 2 is definitely true in each of these 20 worlds. Once I know the world that I am definitely in, the unique world I am in, then I would know with certainty whether alpha 2 is true or false. There's no in between. Okay? Both all these logics, both propositional logic and probabilistic propositional logic, assume that the truth itself is one or zero. Given a unique world, given a complete world, a sentence is either true or it's false. The reason you're getting degrees of belief here is because you're talking about sets of words, where in some sets it's definitely true, in some sets it's definitely false. So you're talking about the percentage of words where it is definitely true. In fuzzy logic, on the other hand, you essentially allow degree of truth itself. That means given a complete world, you can still say this sentence is only 0.5 true in this complete world. Do you understand what I'm saying? We won't talk too much about fuzzy logic because it has all sorts of interesting formal problems in terms of consistency problems for that logic. But as far as this part is concerned, just remember that both of these, all of these logics that we will look at, assume that once you know your world completely, the sentence you're looking at is either definitely true or definitely false. There's no in between. Okay, yes, sir.
So you're saying that if the knowledge base is true, the alpha 3, mm-hmm. you know it's true. How is that? Is there elements that are outside of the knowledge base?
No, because think about what we are trying to compute. Okay, so you woke up one day. You looked around. You can't, not quite sure where you are. But you think either you are in Phoenix or you are in, you know, San Francisco. Okay, now you don't know which place you are in. But it turns out that both of them are on the west side of the US. So am I on the west or the east? Okay, you are on the west. Because irrespective of which actual city you are in, you are on the west follows from your partial knowledge. Do you understand? But on the other hand, some other problems, some other issues such as, let's say, what else can you say? Say something that is true for Phoenix, that's not true for San Francisco. Is it hot? Is it going to be hot? Right? Is it going to be hot? Well, it depends on whether I'm in Phoenix or San Francisco. Many, many places are hot. All I want to know is not what are all the places that can be hot, but whether the place I am in is going to be hot. Okay? And so that's why essentially all you care is this set. There are many other places where alpha 3 can be true, but all you care is the world that you can be in. Only one of these 100 worlds is the ones that you would be in, and in all of those alpha is definitely true.
So we don't care about the worlds that are outside.
Exactly. So nobody cares. When you wake up, you're not interested in what are all the places that are on the west coast of US. What are all the places that are going to have really hot temperature today? You want to know am I in a place which is going to have hot temperature today? And I know partial knowledge about the place I am in. I might be either in Phoenix or in San Francisco. So as far as I'm concerned, if I can say it, whatever I'm trying to say is true in both those places, then it's true. Okay? Again, you know, given the fact that the only people who try to raise their hands thought alpha 2 is the one that is entailed, it's not surprising. People do fall for this, and you have to make sure that your intuitions are, you know, tweaked such that next time around you know that the entailment essentially is the world of the alpha is bigger than the world of the knowledge base. And as you increase your knowledge, the set of worlds consistent with your knowledge, does it increase or reduce? Assuming that adding knowledge means conjoining the knowledge with what you already have, then more you know, the number of worlds consistent with your knowledge are shrinking. At some point of time, it can shrink to nothing. It can become empty. When that happens, you say that my knowledge base is inconsistent. That's what inconsistency means. Okay? Notice that all this discussion was done without talking about how these worlds, you know, what is the structure of these worlds. These could have been mathematical sentences, these could have been propositional logic sentences, these can also be first order logic sentences, and entailment is same, the idea of entailment is the same for all of them. The details will vary based on exactly the number of worlds and, you know, how you enumerate through them. Okay? Okay. So entailment is KB entails alpha, you know, if and only if alpha is true in all the worlds where KB is true. That's the important thing. Not the opposite, but this. Okay? Now, the way you can compute the entailment, the simplest idea is model checking. So write down the set of worlds that are consistent with your knowledge base, sets of words that are consistent with what you want to prove, and do an intersection check. That's what you need to do to compute entailment. Okay? But if the sets are very large, enumerating them can take forever. In particular, once you get to first order logic, the sets are infinite. Okay, so model theoretic checking of entailment is the first principles way of doing it, but oftentimes it's too inefficient. Okay, there are also other ways, shortcuts for checking entailment, such as inference rules, which all of you actually already know. For example, such as if I know that A is true and B is true, so if I know that the sentence A and B is true in the world I'm living in, I definitely know that A is true in the world I'm living in. Do you understand what I'm saying? And that, what you did there is to use an inference rule. You just looked at the syntactic form of sentences and generated new sentences that will also be true. Okay? It turns out that inference tries to compute model theoretic entailment in a short, you know, in a backdoor way. And since it tries to do that, ultimately, what is entailment is completely defined by this particular definition here, which is set theoretic, which is basically in terms of models. It's also called model theoretic definition. Okay? This is trying to compute this in a backhand way, in a backdoor way. So you can then talk about, if the inference says that a sentence is true, is it true really with respect to the model theory? If that property holds, you would say that the inference is sound. So anything I say follows using my inference procedure. If it actually is entailed, then the inference procedure is sound. The other property is completeness. Is it possible for you to write down all the sentences using this inference procedure that would definitely be shown to be entailed if you actually took the long way out? That's the completeness. For those of you who have thought about, let's say, precision and recall for other scenarios, precision is soundness. Precision is a generalization of soundness. Recall is a generalization of completeness. Okay? And we will actually be talking a lot about inference procedures that have soundness and completeness properties. And I can just tell you right now, without too much surprise, that all the inference procedures that you probably know are sound, except the logic that I showed in the beginning of the class, the Python logic, that's not sound. Okay? But all the inference procedures you know, such as, you know, modus ponens, modus tollens, which I'll again repeat here, they're all sound. None of them are complete, even for propositional logic. And resolution, which you may or may not have heard of before, is a complete and sound inference procedure. And that is sort of the climax of this particular discussion, and we'll get there in a few minutes. Okay, so this is basically an inference procedure. Since it's a backdoor way of computing, ultimately, the model theoretic entailment, you want to ask, is it, if it says something is derived, is it really entailed? And so you use this terminology, I mean, this notation for derived. So you would say, KB derives alpha. And you can also say KB derives alpha by inference rule I. And ultimately, what you're really trying to compute is, does KB entail alpha? And if it is sound, that means if alpha is derived, then it's definitely entailed. If it is complete, that means every alpha that is entailed is also derived. Okay? After all this, now we can talk about propositional logic in the next couple of minutes. Because it's basically, you know, you can illustrate all these general ideas in the context of a very simple logic that you all know and love, propositional logic. Okay? For propositional logic, again, I should mention that all the ideas that we talked about till now, up until this slide, they are just general. They are holding, they're going to be true whether you care about propositional logic or first order logic. Okay? So anyway, now, for the syntax of propositional logic, you're not surprised to hear that you have proposition symbols in the propositional logic, and then a sentence can be a proposition, or a negation of a sentence is a sentence. A conjunction of two sentences is a sentence. Disjunction of two sentences is a sentence. One sentence implies another sentence is a sentence. Okay? And one sentence, if and only if another sentence, is also a sentence. Among these two are actually syntactic sugar given the other one. Okay? Because it turns out essentially that when you write A implies B, that's just a different way of writing a disjunction and a negation together, right? You all probably know this. It's basically not A or B. That's what it is. In fact, many a time people have intuitions about what the implication supposed to stand for, and that intuition is not captured by what logic thinks this is. In particular, if I consider A implies B, if A is false, is A implies B true or false? You would think that if something implies something, right, and if the antecedent is already false, you sort of tend to think the implication is sort of false. But if you realize this is nothing but this, okay, if A is false, not A is true, and it doesn't matter what else there is. Do you understand what I'm saying? So once A is false, everything is true. So this is actually why, in fact, this is not surprising. In fact, if you look at all sorts of crazy elementary mathematical paradoxes, which will eventually, after some number of steps, show that 2 equal to 1 or 7 equal to 5, they ultimately all wind up introducing inconsistency somewhere in the reasoning. And once you have inconsistency, then everything follows from there. Because 0 by 0, once you allow 0 by 0, then 0 by 0 can be 7, it can be 9, it can be 25, and they're all consistent. Okay? So you want to keep that in mind, that ultimately implication is nothing but a syntactic sugar for writing not A or B. And what that means is, if the antecedent is false, then the implication is true. Okay, and then the A, if and only if B, is nothing but A implies B and B implies A. And so again, the whole thing is in terms of disjunctions and conjunctions and negations. So ultimately, the only things that you care about are negation, disjunction, conjunction. Everything else is syntactic sugar. Okay. Now, you have in propositional logic, there are specific ways, rules for evaluating truth of a sentence in a complete world. Now, what's a complete world for a propositional logic? If the number of propositions in your knowledge base is P1 to P1000, then a complete world is just truth falsity assignments to each of these propositions. So the total number of complete worlds are nothing but 2 power the number of propositions. Right? Total number of complete worlds are 2 power the number of propositions. You might think that's bad, there are exponential number of worlds. Actually, you should be happy because there are only exponential number of worlds. That means there are only finite number of worlds. Okay? So these sets that we are talking about, none of them are ever going to be infinite. For propositional logic, these sets are not going to be infinite. For first order logic, these sets can actually be infinite. Okay? So, if S is false, not S is true, if S1 is true and S2 is true, then S1 and S2 is true, and so on. You know all this stuff. This is your, syntax for the sentences. So, given a sentence, you now actually can write down all the worlds where that sentence is true. So, you can actually do this computation. If I only have, let's say, 3 propositions that I'm interested in, then there are only 8 possible worlds. And all I need to do is to check out which of the worlds where the sentence is true. And if my knowledge base contains multiple sentences, then I take the intersection of all of them. And now if I want to check if a particular sentence alpha is true, then I just want to make sure that in every world where my knowledge base is true, alpha is true. Not the opposite. Whenever my knowledge base is true, alpha is true. If so, then I'm done. Okay? So that can be done very easily for propositional logic. So for example, my knowledge base, let's say, is A or C and B or not C. This is what you know about the world. You woke up one day and you found either A or C is true. It's also the case that B or not C is true. That's the only thing you know about your world. Okay, this is sort of waking up and realizing I'm either in Phoenix or San Francisco. Okay, now the question is, you want to ask yourself, is A or B definitely true? Irrespective of which of the specific worlds I am in, is A or B definitely true? And I can do this computation, right? I essentially have to make sure that the set of worlds for A or B is a superset of the set of worlds for the knowledge base. That's what I need to check. And I can do this for propositional logic fairly easily because I can just write down the truth tables, and basically the worlds are in the truth tables. Okay, so since the entire knowledge base is just in terms of A, B, and C, then basically I'm only interested in the propositions A, B, and C. Okay, I'm only interested in the propositions A, B, and C. And so I write down this truth table. These are all the only 8 worlds that are possible for me. Okay, in each of those worlds, I can write down the truth and falsity of each of these formulas. If I conjoin them, I'll get the truth of the knowledge base. Separately, I can evaluate the truth of alpha. I just have to make sure that in every row where KB is true, alpha is true. If so, I'm done. If not, I'm not done. Okay? So, you can do it yourself, and basically, this is going to be the truth falsity values for ARC just from the normal definitions. This is for the BR not C, this is for the KB, and this is for the alpha. So all I care about is the set of worlds where KB is true. These two and these two, KB is true. In all those worlds, is the last column true? In all those worlds, is the last column true? Yes. So I just proved to myself what wasn't obvious to you right away, that if this is what you know about your world, this definitely is true. Do you understand what I'm saying? So entailment can be, you know, non-trivial. You know, even with just 3 variables, it wasn't very obvious. You had to do this way. Okay? So alpha is true in all the worlds where the knowledge base is true, and so it's entailed by our definition. Okay? Now here's another interesting thing. Suppose I throw in one extra column for this truth table, which is KB and not of alpha. KB and not of alpha. All you know for sure is in every row where alpha is true, I'm sorry, every row where knowledge base is true, alpha must be true. So not alpha must, for it to be entailed. So not alpha must be false. So in all those rows, this will be false. In all the other rows, knowledge base is false already, so this will be false. So the interesting thing actually is if you throw in this as a sentence, then it must be the case that it would say false, 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 false. So if you don't like going through this jumble of things looking for all the truths, okay, all you need to do is write one extra column and it should have only falses. In which case alpha is satisfied, alpha is entailed, otherwise alpha is not entailed. This is what I was telling you last class. You know, in fact, I told you this idea last class to point out that entailment really is connected to checking constraint satisfaction. Actually, it's connected to checking constraint unsatisfaction, or non-satisfaction of the constraint. Okay? The reason alpha is entailed is because, given what you know, the reason alpha is entailed is because if you were to believe what you know to be true of the world, and to believe alpha to be false, then you have no world which is consistent with your combined knowledge now. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you could actually, even though I wrote this nicely as a, you know, little truth table enumeration problem, you could write this as a SAT problem. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in fact, going back here, I have a propositional constraint here, A or C and B or not C. And in fact, remember I said think in terms of, you know, clauses. And so there are really two clauses. ARC is one clause, BR0C is another clause. Okay? And then I can take this clause ARB, negate it, not of ARB, add it as clauses to this knowledge base. If I take not ARB, that's not in clausal form, but it can be put into clausal form. Not of ARB is nothing but not A and not B. And then that's basically one clause not A, another clause not B. We'll get to this again. It turns out that anything in propositional logic at all can be written down into this clausal form. And this is just an explanation of that, you know, one instance of that. Okay, so now if I take not A, not B as one constraint, this is one constraint, constraint 1, this is constraint 2, and then there's a constraint 3, which is ARC, constraint 4, which is BR0C, and I have a propositional constraint satisfaction problem now. If I can prove to myself this has no solution, that means there is no assignment of values to ABC, truth falsity values to ABC, such that all constraints are satisfied. If I can prove to myself that, then it must be the case that the thing that I negated and threw in was, must have been true. Right? So I know that I can do Boolean constraint satisfaction using normal CSP techniques, but I also talked about this very fast technique at the end of last class, which was local search technique for Boolean constraint satisfaction. Can I use that? Can't use that. It's very fast, but if it gives you a solution, you know there is a solution. If it just goes into the la-la land, you have no clue whether it is going in la-la land because it went into a cycle or because there is really no solution. So local search can't be used for this. You can only use systematic search to prove entailment in a model theoretic way. Okay, again, things are getting connected all over the place. You know, things that you did last class are connected to things being done here. Okay, so to check if knowledge base entails alpha, negate alpha, add it to the knowledge base, try to show that the resultant propositional theory has no solutions. And you must use systematic methods to do that because non-systematic methods, the fact that you didn't find, I mean, if the non-systematic method comes out and gives you a, you know, an assignment, then you know for sure that the theorem is false. But if it doesn't, then you don't know anything. Okay? So connection between entailment and satisfiability. Boolean satisfiability problem is related to propositional entailment. Okay? In fact, it's a conjugate. In one, you're trying to find a satisfying entailment. In the other, I mean, satisfying model, a satisfying assignment. In the other, you're trying to prove that no such thing exists. Okay, and if you are into NP completeness ideas, then essentially, since Boolean satisfiability is an NP complete problem, entailment is a co-NP complete problem. The conjugate problem of an NP complete problem becomes co-NP complete. And what is depressing is that people actually think that co-NP complete is worse than NP complete. Okay, and you can see it partly anyway in here that NP complete problems can be handled. You know, if you assume that there's going to be a solution, you can handle it by local search methods. You can't do that if it's, if you're actually sure that, you want to show that there is no solution. Okay. But in fact, even though I'm going to look at solving the theorems by inference rules. That's what the next idea is going to be. But this is supposed to be hard to do. And in some sense, it's hard to do because you're writing all the assignments. And because we are actually able to solve very large scale CSP problems, it's not as hard to do now as it was 20, 30 years back. Okay, that's all you want to keep in mind. But now we want to look at inference rules. That's the big last point of today's class. Okay, so here is the inference rules that you actually know already. Basically, these are syntactic rules that can be applied to any knowledge base to derive new sentences. And they would, you know, they might be sound and complete, or may not be sound, may not be complete. Okay? Here are some of the rules that you already know. Modus ponens, everybody knows this. implication rule, right? What it says is, if the things in green are in your knowledge base, you're allowed to write the blue thing into your knowledge base. So if you have A implies B in your knowledge base, and if you have A in your knowledge base, then you get to go ahead and write B into your knowledge base. Okay, now what is interesting about this inference rule is the following point, which is, let's say that there are 10,000 propositions that you are talking about, A1 to A10,000. So your knowledge base is talking about 10,000 different propositions. Okay, one particular, you know, that 975th knowledge, the fact in your knowledge base happens to be A77 implies A75. Yet another number, you know, 8954th fact says, by the way, A77 is true. Your inference procedure can cherry pick this and this and write A95 into the knowledge base. To do the same thing using this idea, you need a slightly larger table. You need a table which has 2 power 10,000 rows. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is the reason why we love inference. Okay, as long as your knowledge base basically doesn't have any extraneous things, just 3 or 4 propositions, then model theoretic inference is almost of equal complexity as proof theoretic inference, for propositional logic at least. But you do know a lot more stuff about your world, and currently you're only interested in proving something about the course you are taking, right? And model theoretic inference says, throw the entire thing into the truth table. Now once I write this entire truth table, then I can solve any theorem. Okay, inference one, on the other hand, says I'll cherry pick the pieces and prove what I want to prove, and they'll definitely be true, you know, if it is sound. But I might get there much faster. Okay, and my analogy for this is baking potatoes in a conventional oven versus microwave oven. Why? If you want one potato to be baked, you want to use microwave oven. If you want 100 to be baked, you want to fire up the conventional oven, which takes forever to set up, but then an extra potato here and there doesn't make a difference for it. Okay? This is a huge conventional oven we are talking about. Once you write the entire truth table, which only people, you know, nobody in their right mind would do, but if you do that, then you're ready to solve any theorem. Give me the theorems now. And all I need is one extra column for each theorem. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. Now, modus tollens is an interesting thing which you may or may not have thought about recently. It says A implies B and B is not true, then you can be sure that A is not true. Now, here's my question. I wrote modus tollens, you all of you kind of agree that it's sound, you know, but how do you actually prove that something is sound? It turns out that you prove something is sound by going back to the truth table. And you prove it once, and then you can always use this rule. Okay, so for example, for modus tollens, I want to prove that it's sound by writing this little truth table here. Okay, I have A, B, A implies B, and the knowledge base, and not A. Okay, and then this is the only row where the knowledge base happens to be true, and in this row, not A is also true. So I just proved to myself that whatever I am doing is sound. This is how you prove soundness of an inference rule. Now, Python logic actually looks like this. A implies B, okay, and A is not true. So B should not be true. This is not, you know, we tend to do this. In fact, This is called an abductive inference. It's not, you know, logically sound, but it is probabilistically sound. Okay, but from a logical point of view, in fact, there could be other reasons why B became true. So A would, if you think of this as causation, A is causing B, W also can cause B. Just because A is not true doesn't mean B won't be true. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you have flu, you get fever. You don't have flu. Can I prove that you don't have fever? No. You could have some other deadly disease. You know, 10,000 more other diseases, and you are, you know, boiling in fever. Okay. So abductive inference is not sound from propositional entailment point of view. Right? Now, how do I prove that? Again, use the same idea. Here is a little truth table for the abductive inference. Okay, so here is the A column, here is the B column, A implies B column. This is the knowledge base column, which basically takes the A implies B column and conjoins with the not A. Okay, and then this is the not B column. And these are the two worlds where knowledge base is true. And unfortunately, in one of those two worlds, B is not true. Not B is not true. Just because of that guy, abduction is not sound. All you need is one world where your knowledge base is actually, I mean, one world that's consistent with your knowledge base, but in that, alpha isn't true. Do you understand? So, in terms of this picture, you know, in terms of this picture, if you remember from the beginning of the class, if all of these guys and then one extra world here are consistent with knowledge base, then all of a sudden alpha 3 is no longer entailed, because this extra world is not, in that extra world alpha 3 is not true. You need just one exception. And if you went to probabilistic logic, then you start talking about the weight of the world, the percentage of worlds where the exceptions are occurring, and that gives you the degree of belief. Okay, now the last thing, so you have modus ponens, modus tollens, chaining inference. If A implies B, B implies C, you get to write A implies C. Prove to yourself using this kind of an idea that it's a sound inference. And we already said this is not sound. Okay, so it turns out that these are all sound inferences, but none of them are complete. Because I will give you an example. In fact, I'll give you an example here. Okay, I have the two following sentences in my knowledge base. Okay, which is, if W, then J is true. Then, and also if not W, then also J is true. I put some semantics for why those sentences are there that are politically unnecessary. But these are two sentences that are logically, you know, in the right syntax. My question is, just using your intuition, not your political beliefs, is J true? If these two sentences are true in the world you are living in, can you be sure that J is true in that world? Yeah, because either W is true or it's false. And if W is true, then J is true. If W is false, then J is true still. So you're true either way, so J is true. Can you prove that using modus ponens? Turns out no. Check it out yourself. Can you prove it using modus tollens? You can't do it. There is no elementary propositional logic inference rule that you know which can be used to prove that J is true. And is J entailed? Of course it is. In fact, if you write a nice little truth table, you will be able to see that this and this and not J column would be always false. So it is entailed. And, you know, that's what your intuition is also telling you. And yet you're unable to prove it. Because of which you lose completeness. Okay. Now, it turns out basically that there is this idea called, what you need to do in these kinds of scenarios essentially is you have to do case analysis. The world in which you are in, either W is true or W is false. Let's assume if W is true and try to prove J. Now, if I proved it there, then now assume that W is false and try to prove J is true. And if I proved in both cases, then I have proved it in all world. This case analysis is what is not present in any of these inference rules. The advantage of that is that because you can do case analysis, if you can do case analysis, you will become complete. Okay, there is a simple idea called resolution inference, which is shown right there. Okay, all it's saying is if alpha, so you know, I'm writing in terms of alpha and beta there, but I'll write in the A and B here. If you happen to know A or B is true, and you also happen to know that not A or C is true, then in essence you can get rid of these two and write B or C. That's the resolution inference rule. You can prove that this is sound. That's a homework assignment for you. You can just prove there are only three variables, I mean three propositions. So it's like a 8-row table. In that 8-row table, you can say that if you take a column which corresponds to this, this, and a negation of this, that'll always be false. Or if you consider all the worlds where both of these are true, then B or C is also true in those worlds. Okay? But resolution is a complete inference. And if you use resolution repeatedly, you will actually be able to prove every theorem that is provable in propositional logic. So I'm sorry, what I showed here is that resolution is a sound inference. And I'm just stating a fact, which without proof, that resolution is also complete. To prove that resolution is complete, you have to provide a inductive proof, saying that for every theorem that is provable, there exists a finite set of steps of resolution that will get you to the proof of that theorem. I won't go into that, but the textbook actually has a sketch of that proof, if you're interested. Okay, now, because resolution is sound and complete, if you just keep applying resolution multiple times, then you will be able to prove everything that's provable. So this basically is one thing that you may not have heard of before coming here, you know, from just propositional logic. Resolution inference is a sound and complete inference. The last thing I want you to think about is, and we will, next class we'll actually go into more details about using resolution inference, and I'll also point out that trying to prove a theorem that you're trying to prove might involve a huge amount of search. Because in trying to prove some theorem, there may be a sequence of resolutions that you get to do that will get you to prove that theorem. But there are a huge number of other resolutions that you get to prove. That is not what you wanted to prove. How do you make sure that you do the right one? There's no magic. You search. You consider all branches and look for the branches that are likely to lead you to the proof. So there is a proof in theorem proving. Okay? Now, the last thing I want you to understand is, this side, except this guy, these and these are sound inference rules, but they are not complete. Can you think of a complete inference rule that's not sound? Can you think of complete inference rule that's not sound? Yes. The answer is yes. Ask me a theorem. My answer would be yes. Right? Do you understand what I'm saying? So you tell me whatever you know and you say, Rao, is alpha true? I'll say yes. Is beta true? I'll say yes. Is not alpha true? I'll say yes. Is not beta true? I'll say yes. I'm complete. Because since I'm saying yes for everything, every possible true theorem is also a got an yes from me. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, this is again, if all you want is recall in information retrieval and you don't care about precision, then Google can, for every query, send its entire database to you, saying, here are all the results. And it's there somewhere in this. And it can't be wrong. It will be complete. Nobody can prove that what they're looking for isn't in this database of 8 billion pages. The problem is getting completeness while keeping soundness. And it's also the case that if you have to give up one thing, it makes no sense to give up soundness. Because you can write trivially complete inference procedures that are useless, such as yes, the yes man or the yes woman, you know, who whenever the boss asks, do you think based on what we know this is true? Whatever you say so far. If you think yes, it's yes. Okay, those are trivial. That's why it's actually at least slightly interesting to try to come up with things that are sound but not complete. And the true jackpot is coming up with this, which is both sound and complete. And it turns out that for it to become complete, it also is the case that, remember that the original problem is co-NP complete. So running, and I also told you that everything that can be proved by resolution. Which means running resolution to prove a theorem can, in the worst case, be exponential. This should not be surprising to you at all, because the original problem was exponential, and this guy is going to solve the entire problem, so it has to be exponential. Whereas, if you're only interested in proving things that are provable by this or this, that's polynomial. So people still think about this because sometimes they just don't want to spend exponential amount of time trying to prove theorems. So they do sound but incomplete fast inference techniques. And the last thing you want to keep in mind is forward checking that you did as part of CSP is a sound, fast, incomplete inference procedure. Okay? We'll stop here. We'll come back next class and go into the search for resolution.